Hello, and welcome to the TA teleconference, Publish and Flourish, moderated by Tara Gray, presenter of the TAA-sponsored workshop, Publish and Flourish, Become a Prolific Scholar. Tara is an associate professor of criminal justice and the first director of the Teaching Academy at New Mexico State University. She has published 3 books, including her most recent, Publish and Flourish, Become a Prolific Scholar. She has been honored at NMSU and nationally with 8 awards for teaching or service. Tara has presented her workshop to more than 3,000 scholars in more than 25 states and in Thailand, Canada, Mexico, and Guatemala. This will be an open discussion, but we would like to minimize any background noises by asking all participants to press 4-star to mute themselves. When you want to comment or ask a question, you can press 4-star again to speak. And then to remute yourself, press 4-star. We're going to try that today and see if that works. I now turn the teleconference over to Tara Gray.
Well, thank you very much. I wanted to start with introductions and to hear from each of you why you're here, what you hope to take away today. So, Kimberly, do you want to start?
Sure. I am here because I am a faculty member at Eastern Kentucky University, and I'm actually working on a couple of papers with some other people, articles to be submitted, and I just want to keep working and get some other ideas on how to get the most out of the writing and, you know, get the writing done so that I can send it off and, you know, move on to the next one.
Wonderful. Thank you. Arena, would you comment?
Yes, hello, this is Arena. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, I was playing with that 4-star button. Yes, I'm a faculty member as well here in San Diego, California, teaching international business courses at community colleges, and I'm writing my first book on importing and exporting. And I'm also a doctoral student at the same time.
Oh, wow.
Working on my dissertation. So I'm also hoping to get some ideas on how to have my, interest expressed in the dissertation published at a later time. So those are my interests, and I hope to get some answers during this conference.
Excellent. I hope you do. I think you will.
Thank you.
Kathleen, are you there?
Yes. Hello. This is Kathleen.
Tell us about yourself. What brings you here?
What brings me here? Well, I am in the process of writing a textbook, the most daunting thing I've ever taken on in my life. The textbook topic is healthcare curriculum for non-native English speaking students.
Uh-huh.
And it has a kiss and a promise from a major publishing house and not yet a contract, because I have several chapters written, mostly written, not polished yet. And I'm actually just looking for support and encouragement and little bits of information and maybe some motivation to do better with keeping up with my own internal deadline situation that I've imposed upon myself, mostly just to connect with people who are, you know, doing similar things.
Wonderful. Well, you're in the right place.
I should tell you, I'm sorry, I forgot to tell you, that I have a master's in teaching English as a foreign language, but I also have, my bachelor's degree is in human services counseling, psych, and prior to that, when I was just a young thing, I was a registered nurse, and I also pursued and almost finished a master of fine arts in creative writing. So I have a lot of different backgrounds that I'm pulling together to put this textbook together.
Yes, it sounds like it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, welcome.
Thank you.
Barbara, are you there?
I sure am. I'm an adjunct instructor at Case Western Reserve University and finishing, graduating on May 18th, not that anybody's counting, Dr. and so I'm here also looking to get help, and I echo the encouragement as far as article writing and submission. And also, I'm partway through a book and have a list of several more that I'd like to write. So just looking for help, encouragement, those type of things to flourish.
Great. Well, that's why we're here, too. So that's good. Barry?
Hi. I'm here at SUNY Albany, and I guess I have two reasons for participating. One is I'm into, for me, a relatively new area of research. So I got so many good ideas out of the workshop when you were here that I wanted to get like a booster session just to kind of reaffirm my direction. And then secondly, I'm now teaching a course in the doctoral program, so I'm hoping to kind of take some of those ideas and renew those ideas and take them back to some of the doctoral students as well.
Oh, great. Well, I will talk specifically about doing that, and I have a lot of materials for doing that, and if you email me, I will send you like a PowerPoint and an article for you and an article for them and so on and so forth.
Oh, okay. That would be great.
It helps transfer this material to students.
Okay.
Is that everybody besides Richard and Kim? Did you want to share, Richard or Kim? Okay. Are you there?
This is Richard.
Oh, good.
Okay.
I
just wanted to say I was impressed with the wonderful and varied backgrounds of people. When I was an undergraduate, I had five majors in six semesters before I finally settled on one that carried me through graduate school, and I'm very appreciative of people with a lot of interest that try to juggle them all. I'm executive director of the Texas and Academic Authors Association, and I wanted to encourage all of you, I don't know whether you're all members, but I wanted to encourage you to join because we have, among other things, an excellent listserv where people post questions and difficulties that they're having, puzzles, how do I get permissions, a whole range of things. And we have a membership now of about 1,400, and you will get lots of people who have been there and done that and be able to help you out. So let me just encourage you to make use of this fine organization. That's all.
Great. Well, I have about 25 or 45 minutes of material prepared, and that includes time for questions. So please stop me. In an audience, I would see you and know that you wanted to ask something, but you really just have to interrupt to get my attention in this format. So please do interrupt freely because I am not pressed for time, and I want to reach your needs and say more about, this is a six-hour workshop compressed into 45 minutes. So I want to hit some of the highlights, but wherever you would like to learn more, I would be happy to say more if you'll just stop me. Does that sound fair enough? I know you're all muted, so you you probably can't say yes.
Fair enough. I got it.
Great. All right. Well, this is Publish and Flourish, Become a Prolific Scholar. And new slide. We teach what we most want to know, so I come by the teaching of writing honest. I had finished my dissertation. I had published my first academic article without incident. I had finished what I hoped would be my second academic article. I observed that I had spent 100 hours per page. That's after the numbers were crunched, after the data were collected. That was writing only. I thought it might be ready to go, so I shared it with 10 of the best-known experts in the world. Five of them answered. They seemed to like it. I made the changes they suggested, and I sent it out for review, and this is what came back in red ink, half an inch high. This paper is very poorly done. It's a very badly prepared piece of work. It's plagued by myriad problems. And my personal favorite, this paper is so badly written that few persons will have patience to try to make sense of it. New slide. I knew just what to do. I cried. When I was done crying, I said to myself, there must be a moral to the story, because what I had done was I had taken the article to my office and I had written for 4.5 hours, which was less than 0.5% of the time spent on the paper. And in that 4.5 hours, I had sent out the paper to another equally good journal where it was accepted without revision. So I thought, surely there must be some kernel of knowledge here, and I decided there was more than one. First of all, ignore the overall assessment of the paper, but concentrate on the specific concrete suggestions they give you. So whether they love it or they hate it, don't concentrate on that. Concentrate on what they tell you to do. Secondly, ask less expert readers to read for you. I went straight to the top, and that's one good audience, but it's not the only audience or even the best. They tell you certain kinds of things, but they omit telling you certain other kinds of things. For example, my paper was poorly organized. It read like a paint-by-number kit. Move this here, move this over there, move this here. The experts did not comment on organization, because they weren't reading to understand. They already understood. And because of that, they read right past bad organization. So I should have asked less expert readers to read for me. New slide. Like many of you, I went to the school of hard knocks as a writer. It's not the best school, and it's certainly not the only school. Much is known about how to become a more prolific scholar, and anybody can. And that's what we'll be talking about today. New slide. I said to myself, there should be a program to help scholars flourish. And now there is. This one's for you. I hope you like it. New slide. Naturally, it's a 12-step program. Because writing is difficult, and writing well is a lifetime project. But steps counter the difficulty. They break something big down into little tiny units that anybody can do. The steps work if you work the steps. You'll be surrounded by evidence today that the steps work if you work them. But it's still hard to decide to work the steps because as academics, we're trained skeptics. We're trained to question everything from the size of the sample to the quality of the data. And while it's true that one size doesn't fit all, it's a better system instead of rejecting the whole set of steps. It's a better system to try each step on for size and see if it makes you a better writer. It's an empirical question after all. So suspend disbelief and fake it till you make it. New slide. My challenge to you is to work the steps and see how they work in your life. And every time you fall off the writing wagon, to climb right back on and try the steps again. New slide.
Sarah, could I interrupt a minute?
You can indeed.
This is Richard. I think that remark you made several slides ago about the difference between the expert reviewer and the person who's not the expert is really profound. To have someone look at what you're trying to say who doesn't know it is in many respects can be a lot more valuable to you than somebody who knows it all and is just simply trying to judge whether you've hit all the high spots.
Yep.
So I just wanted to emphasize, I think that sharing with non-experts or less expert individuals is really important. I used to have my mother read my papers when
I was in
graduate school, and I did that because my brother had gotten a PhD and in horticulture, and he sent her a copy, and she sat down with my aunt, and they rewrote his dissertation, which was about 100 pages, into 3 pages. And sent it back to him and said, are you saying anything else but this? And it was a good lesson in humility. So, yeah, anybody that you can get to read it is going to give you valuable insight.
Yes, I think you're totally right, and we'll come back to that point a little bit later again, but I have certainly had better luck with pieces when I've had a variety of readers read for me rather than just the big experts. Well, the 12 steps are broken into a set of steps, and you should be on a slide now that shows all the sets of steps. There's 6 sets, and we'll start with managing time, new slide, and new slide again. We will start with step 2. In the interest of time, we won't hit every step. If you want the book, it's got all the steps in it, and I believe an order form for the book is in your packet, so in your handouts. Step 2 is write 15 to 30 minutes daily. Research shows that scholars who write daily write more minutes total by a factor of 2 than those who don't write daily, but they generate many times more pages and papers. So sell your stock in Big Blocks of Time Incorporated. Don't worry, it's selling briskly on a street corner near you. The people who need big blocks of time to write didn't write yesterday, honest. If you're still not convinced, ask yourself this question. When was the last time a big block of time dropped in on you? When you wait for a big block of time, first you wait for summer, then you wait for sabbatical. And my personal favorite are people I actually know who are waiting for retirement. Don't wait. Set aside a short block of time to write today. Write something, write anything, but write it now. New slide. Should be the slide that says step 3, record daily and share weekly. It's not enough to tell people that they should write daily and just hope that they do, because it doesn't work. But if you write daily and you record your time spent writing daily and you share those records with someone else, it works. So Bob Boyce, the guru of scholarly writing, he was a social psychologist from the SUNY system who wrote 200 articles and 4 books on writing daily. And he found that when he would do a group of people, he did 2-day workshops. He'd do a 2-day workshop with a group, and then he'd say, who wants to write daily and who wants to continue writing in big blocks of time? The first group that wrote in big blocks of time generated a whopping 17 pages of prose a year. But the second group, who attended the workshops and agreed to write daily and record it, generated 64 pages of prose a year. So a 4 times increase just for keeping records that are private between you and God. There was a third group. The third group attended the workshops, agreed to write daily, record it, and be held accountable for writing daily. This group generated 157 pages of prose in a year. So not only keeping records, but being held accountable makes another big jump. So now you've got a 9 times increase in your writing by just keeping records and sharing them with someone else. There was another study. It's a better study because it's a pre-post study. So you assume in the last study, a more motivated group chose the more stringent interventions. But in this pre-post study, he got tougher as time went on. And if you were even going to go to his workshop, you were going to participate in his program. So you signed on to that before you even went. In the first year, people were binge writing, which means writing in blocks of time greater than 3 hours. He studied people who wrote more than 3 hours and found they threw out most of what they had written after the 3-hour mark. So except for grant proposals, he says never binge write. But in the first year, they were all binge writing. In the second year, they wrote daily, kept records, and held themselves accountable to others. And in the first year, 10% finished a manuscript, but in the second year, 100% finished a manuscript. New slide. So without records and accountability, you will write tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow, but tomorrow never comes. And keeping records increased output 4 times, sharing records increased output between 9 and 10 times, depending on the study. So what questions or comments do you have at this point about writing daily?
This is Kimberly.
Yes.
And what I found is that I'm faculty and not tenure track. I didn't mention that earlier. I'm not tenured yet, so I've got, you know, all the work ahead of me. And I usually schedule a time to go to the library on a certain day of the week so that I'm out of my office and away from where people are going to come bug me all the time. So I'm just wondering if, I guess, kind of how to get the extra 15 to 30 and, like, I hear what you're saying, but my brain goes, but I'd really like my 3 hours in the library. So for those people never taking blocks of time or...
Oh, there's nothing wrong with blocks of time if they're in addition to writing daily. But writing daily keeps the flame of your research alive, and you will think about it for 24 hours, your subconscious will, but no longer. So you want to write 15 minutes every day, even if on one day you do take a full 3 hours.
Okay, and I had one other question, which you may mention later, but sometimes I actually do get the time and write things every day, but I find more troublesome for me is finding the time to read everything I want to read so that I can cite everything I need to cite.
Yes.
For getting all the reading in that you need to get done.
Well, the way I like to work is I like to write 15 to 30 minutes a day and then turn right around and do my research for the next day, which is another 15 to 30 minutes to prepare me to write the next day. But Boyce didn't care if you did your reading in big blocks of time. He just encouraged you to do your writing every day. So you could take 3 hours one day a week and do a lot of reading if that worked better for you.
I see. Okay, thank you.
Sara?
Yes.
Richard again. I really like your allusion to sort of thinking or writing subconsciously, and the way I think of it is writing every day is a way of downloading what you have been processing or churning around in your,
yes,
in your subconscious. And if you develop that ability, you can actually find yourself during the day checking in to see how the writing is going, and get a sense of when what you're trying to write is about ready to download, and then you're sort of taking dictation.
Yep, that's a great way to think of it.
Tara?
Yes.
This is Kathleen. I was just thinking about something that I told my students today. I'm an adjunct professor at a university up here in New Hampshire. By the way, I forgot to mention that. But today, they were in a wonderful conversation, and I opted not to give them a break because they were on a roll. And I'm realizing that I gave them really good advice. You know, if you go get a cup of coffee and smoke a cigarette, you're going to lose your momentum. And it just now occurred to me that that's what I've been doing with my writing, is losing my momentum, waiting for big blocks of time. I'm not sure if you guys get the connection, but it's sort of making sense to me now that, you know, the advice I gave to my students is easily transposed to the writing process of writing every day without that gap. Because when I have a gap, and sometimes it's weeks, and I go back to it, like semester break is coming up on the 21st of March, and I'm saying, oh, I am going to get so much writing done on that break. And I've done that before, and I know what's going to happen. I'm going to open up all my files, my thousands of files and piles and heaps, and say, where was I?
Right.
What was I thinking? Where was I going? How, you know, I do this all the time. And I'm not making a whole heck of a lot of progress here.
And it takes big blocks of time to write when we write in big blocks of time because it's been so long since we started,
mm-hmm,
that it takes a long time to start up.
Yes.
But if you write every day, you have almost no startup time because you've been thinking about it all night.
Exactly. And having those big gaps of time also, for better or for worse, often causes me to say, I think I'll take a different direction. And then it's almost like starting all over again.
Yeah.
That's all. Just sharing.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody else before we move on? Okay. We'll go on to revising. You should be on the revising slide. And now the new slide that says step six, organize around key sentences. Naturally, you want 1 point per paragraph because that's a cultural norm. And the point should be suggested in one sentence early in the paragraph. A key sentence is to a paragraph as a street sign is to a city. It orients the reader and helps them navigate. It's like a topic sentence in that it announces the topic of the paragraph simply and with little detail, without trying to prove the point. It tells what the rest of the paragraph is about. We're going to hunt for key sentences in a minute in your handout. And when we do, ask yourself, when you come to a sentence that you think is key, is the rest of the paragraph about that? If the rest of the paragraph is about that, if you've kind of settled into the topic, then you've found the key or topic sentence. They're like topic sentences in another way. They're broad enough to cover everything in the paragraph, but no broader. You need to use keywords as subjects. Just like when we talk, we raise and lower our voice to get attention. When we write, we use keywords as subjects. So instead of saying, he was a short man and a powerful one too, or loudly, he was a short man and a powerful one too, and your students scramble to write it down, and they're all thinking, who? And so you want to put your keyword Napoleon in your sentence. Napoleon was a short man and a powerful one too. They're different from topic sentences in that you may have been taught that topic sentences must be first, but key sentences are not necessarily the first sentence in the paragraph. In fact, they have different placement in different disciplines. And this is a new slide, and it should say worksheets on key sentences, page 7 to 8 at the top in red, because I have failed to say new slide a couple of times. The directions on number 1, 3, and 5 only of the sample paragraphs, write the number of the best available key sentence, if any. Don't expect perfection. These are not model paragraphs, they're just typical paragraphs. So try to find if there's any possible key sentence. And if the paragraph has no key sentence, write 0. And then write and insert a key sentence. And then we'll discuss paragraphs 1, 3, and 5 in, let's say, 3 minutes. So I'll give you 3 minutes to do this, or maybe 5 if you need it. And it's pages 7 and 8 of your handout. That's 3 minutes. Is anybody done yet? Maybe just check in when you are done.
This is Kimberly. I'm done, but I think that's just a scary proposition because you might ask me to tell you what I found.
No, I'm glad you're done. Let's get a couple more people done before we move on.
I'm done, and I echo her thoughts.
Hi, this is Kathleen. I didn't get the paragraph handout. I got repeats of what had already been sent to me, so I get to sit back and just listen.
Oh, dear, you don't have the paragraphs. Do you have the PowerPoint?
I have the PowerPoint, but not
the Look ahead in the PowerPoint to see the paragraph so you'll see where we're going.
Yeah, I already did that.
Oh, okay, good.
So I'm all set, but I'm off the hook. Thanks.
Irina and Barbara, are you still there? Barry?
Yes, I'm sorry. This is Barbara, and I have finished also.
Okay, let's move on. I think we've got most of us. Okay, if you move to the next slide, it shows, well, that's not too ideal because it shows the answer. It does on mine anyway. If you move to the first slide and don't click twice, it'll show you the paragraph without the answer. What did people think about the first paragraph? What did you think the key sentence was?
This is Kimberly. That's the sentence I chose.
Oh, good. Number one is the sentence you chose. Good. That should be the simplest and the best paragraph. I'm going to talk about two things, A and B, and then they talk about one, and then they talk about the other. The only thing that can confuse people in this paragraph is there's a wonderful sentence a little further down, the issue promises, the discussion delivers, which tells you more than saying I'm going to talk about two things, the issue and the discussion, but because of placement, I didn't choose it because it's further down, and we need a roadmap of where we're going before we get there. So the second paragraph, what did you mark? It's paragraph number three, actually.
I said there weren't any.
You said there weren't any.
Right.
It's a tough paragraph.
This is Kimberly. I had the sentence of in this study and then the next sentence, and I kind of was in a toss-up between those because the second sentence mentions kind of what the whole thing was, but the one before that says just that I used it. So I was kind of in a toss-up between those two.
Okay.
This is Barbara. I also chose the in the study sentence.
Okay, that's what I chose. And the reason I chose it is to me the first sentence is saying that true value will always be positive, and the second one is saying it's not always positive. And the third one is saying there's many things we could do, but in this study we will use the Brennan approach. And they finally stick with the Brennan approach. Whereas in the first sentence they could have written a paragraph about how it has to be positive in theory. The second sentence they could have written a paragraph about how it's negative in sometimes. But they didn't write those paragraphs. They just briefly touched on those points before settling on, in this study we're going to use the Brennan approach. They could have also written a paragraph about the many approaches you could use before they got to the sentence about the Brennan approach. So this is very compressed prose, but I think it's pretty typical of what we see in academia, where people know that they're supposed to be positive in theory, they know that they're occasionally negative in practice, and they know that there are many approaches, but the Brennan approach is the one they're going to use. And on the final one, example five, this is the hardest. What did you choose as the key sentence?
This is Kimberly, and I'll just admit that this is just a bunch of gobbledygook. Like, it all, I'm sure, makes sense to people who know this history, but I don't, so I couldn't find anything to help me figure out what it was about.
Okay. So you put a zero.
Right.
No sentence. Did anybody else put a zero and try to write a sentence for this paragraph? I'll take that as a no. Williams and Cologne says it has no key sentence, too, and they erased the first sentence and wrote the sentence, "After Peter the Great died, 7 out of 8 reigns were plagued by turmoil over disputed succession to the throne." And that's what's at stake here in this paragraph, is disputed succession to the throne. And that's what a key sentence should tell us. Whereas in the paragraph as it was written, it starts talking about palace revolt or popular revolution in the first sentence, where we would hope to find a clue for where we're going. But it actually isn't about palace revolt or popular revolution. It's about disputed succession to the throne. So that's the examples, and if you go to a new slide, you'll see that once you found a key sentence for every paragraph, you should try to find one for every section of the paper. That means the intro, the methods, the results, the discussion, and so on. And, of course, one for the whole paper. And because sections have keys, it's possible that sometimes a paragraph may legitimately have two keys, one working as a section key and one working as a paragraph key. But usually a paragraph with two keys is just an overworked paragraph. You need to write two paragraphs or dump an idea. And that brings us to step 7, new slide. Use key sentences as an after-the-fact outline. Keys make an excellent outline because they're apparent to the reader. The reader can see the outline in the paper because they see these key sentences, as opposed to those kinds of outlines that I used to keep that were a private thing between me and God in a separate document. And sometimes they were better than the paper, more to the point. But they weren't useful to the reader because the reader didn't have access to them. So you can use your word processor to hide all the text except the headings and the key sentences. And the way to do this is shown if you use the words hidden text to search in WordPerfect or Microsoft Word. Use hidden text to find out how to hide everything except the headings and the key sentences. And then you can hide it or you can show it all. And when you show it all, you've got the whole paper. And when you hide it, you've got an outline of your paper. New slide. Read your list. Ask yourself how the key sentences could better communicate the purpose to the audience. And then read it one more time. And ask yourself how the key sentences could be better organized, and by that I mean more logical and more coherent. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Read your list twice and ask yourself these questions. It's a wonderful way to clean up your prose. New slide. It should say other uses in the middle of the page. You can start your writing sessions daily with key sentences. And by that I mean you can just read your key sentences and it'll get your thoughts going. It's kind of like the part of a roller coaster where you go up, click, 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 and then into the ride. So reading your key sentences often gets you started. You can use it to write abstracts. I can write a better abstract in 2 hours or even an hour or even 20 minutes than I used to write in 2 days. I used to spend hours upon hours upon hours writing abstracts, but now I just line up my key sentences, and usually the key sentences from the introduction provide the key points that I need to mention in my abstract, and maybe a couple from the conclusion. So I just mark out all the ones that don't belong in the abstract, and I usually have too many having done that one pass. And then I do a second pass and mark out some more, and a third pass if necessary, until I get it down to 5 to 7 sentences. And then I'm ready to write my abstract. You can use it to grade stacks of papers. If you email me, I'm at taragray.com is the easiest. TARAGRAY.com says email Tara everywhere. So just email me that way. If you want a handout for the students, a handout for yourself, and PowerPoint, as I mentioned earlier. What it basically is I was taught to grade every paper twice because you're more fair when you do that. And I got lazy after about 10 years, and I thought, you know, I'm an experienced grader, and I don't have time for this. So I stopped grading every paper twice, and the good news is I was mostly accurate, I think. I accidentally, however, graded one paper twice. And the good news is I wrote all the same comments on the paper. The bad news is I gave it a different grade by a full letter grade. So I saw how inaccurate even experienced graders are when we grade papers only once. So it was back to the stacks where you put the A's in a stack, the B's in a stack, the C's in a stack, and then you read all the A's to see if they're equal and you read all the B's to see if they're equal. But I was too lazy to read the paper twice by now. So I thought I'll just have them put the thesis and the key sentences on the first page. And I'll read the thesis and the key sentences. And if it's an A, I'll put it in the A pile. And then all I have to check, I've already checked the thesis and the organization. All I have to check when I get to the paper is the evidence. Is the evidence also an A? If it is, it stays an A. If not, it moves down. And so on and so forth. So grading became very easy for me, and I get very few complaints. And finally, you can use it to work with thesis or dissertation students. I just read the key sentences and discuss the big points with them until their key sentences are logical and coherent, until every key sentence supports the purpose. And when that is all accomplished, then I'm ready to turn the page and start reading their paper. And it might sound harsh, but it has reduced the tension between me and my students manyfold. Because there used to be a lot of tension because I was spilling red ink over all their paper and it was hurting their feelings. And now I'm just having a simple 20-minute chat with each student each week about their key sentences. And once we get that all nailed down, then I'm ready to turn and read some prose that makes sense. So right. Questions or comments on key sentences?
Yes, I do. I've been waiting. I'm amazed at how I'm able to transpose. Because you're basically in most cases talking about papers, and I'm talking about a textbook. But other uses, and as you were talking about writing abstracts, how it makes writing an having these key sentences just stand alone and look you in the face, it just occurred to me how useful it is when in a chapter. Often I write a chapter. And then I write the objectives.
Yes.
Objectives, for some reason, I can write a syllabus and spit out objectives without thinking about it. Because I've, you know, done the same courses several times, and it's just, you know, it comes natural. Writing the textbook is another whole genre to me. Because it's when you write a textbook, you're kind of developing a curriculum simultaneously. You know, it's hard to explain, but that's what you're doing. But if these key points were jumping out at me, like you suggested, with blocking out everything else, if all of my paragraphs had clear key sentences, you can flip them into an objective without even a whole lot of effort.
Yes, you can. And although I am mostly talking about articles, primarily because I'm an article writer, a textbook is more important to be clear and more important to have key sentences because you're talking to novices.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
So even though they're important in an academic article, they're more important in a textbook.
Mm-hmm. And I thought I've been focusing on key sentences until I thought deeper when I looked at the slide. But when it occurred to me how much help it can be creating objectives over and over and over again, it seems like a no-brainer in a way. But so thank you for this.
Good. Thank you.
Thanks so far. Thank you.
Anybody else want to comment before we move on? Okay, if you'll switch to a new slide, it's called Getting Help, and this is what Richard was commenting on earlier. We want to share our drafts with three groups of readers. Non-experts, people in a discipline other than our own, could be your mother, like Richard said. Experts, anybody in your same general discipline. And capital E experts, anybody who writes in your exact discipline, and especially if they write very successfully in that exact discipline. Share early drafts with non-experts. This is a new slide. You want to share with very safe readers, and you can find safe readers like your mother, who's always going to love your stuff. You can find safe readers among non-experts. You have no need to impress them, and equally important, they have no need to impress you. This is important because a lot of experts won't comment on clarity because they don't want to seem to not understand. For fear you'll say, you don't understand? Well, you wouldn't. So with non-experts, there's nothing they won't ask in terms of clarity, and bad organization is not transparent to them. Sometimes they can't understand much of what you're saying, but they can tell you, look, you're talking about A here, and you were talking about A down there. So you need to put these two together and say it right once. Share later drafts with experts. You want to share the middle drafts with little e experts, and you can treat them like capital E experts or like non-experts, depending on the stage of the writing and how well you know them. And finally, you want to share near final drafts with at least two capital E experts. Why near final? Because you are writing to impress now. You want them to like your stuff and you want them to cite your stuff. Why at least two? Because they won't all answer you. In my experience, about 60% answer you if you, new slide, tailor a letter just for them, telling them how their work informed yours, and asking them questions about the intersection of your work and theirs. This is the hook. These guys may be famous academics, but they don't get a lot of fan mail. So they answer, as I mentioned, about 60% of the time, and it's because they're very interested in people who are tilling the same intellectual fields that they're tilling. I like to ask what one or two articles should I read that I haven't, and I like to ask what journal would you put this in. It shows me how what they think of it without having to tell me that they think it's only a so-so article. But if they tell me a so-so journal, then I know where they think it fits in the greater scheme of things. And I can write them back and say, oh, I was considering XYZ journal. How do you think it compares to ABC journal that you recommended? I volunteer to read for them now or at any time. Joe Williams at Chicago taught me that. He told me that I wrote him and I said, I was about 26 and he was at Chicago. And I was like, I'm nobody and nothing and I'm writing you from Nowheresville, but I was hoping you might possibly please read this paper for me. And he wrote back, sure, I'll read this paper for you if you read the three chapters of my latest book as enclosed. And it taught me that just as he is an important part of my audience, I am an important part of his audience. So then I ask for a quick read. I tell them, just run your eyes over this. Spend no more than 20 minutes on it. And I ask them when I can expect to hear from them. I used to ask for a turnaround in 2 or 3 weeks, but I thought that was too bold. So now I say, when can I expect to hear from you? They never answer that in the first email. They just say they're willing, and then I have to write them back and ask them again, when can I expect to hear from you? Because I want to send them the latest version of the paper at that time. And if other people have read it first, I want to have included those comments. So if they, for example, say it will be 2 weeks, in 1 week, I send them the latest paper, and I say, you hope to read it this week, and I'm looking forward to hearing from you. Here's the latest copy. Are there questions or comments about getting feedback from others before we close this out with Polishing Pros? Okay. Polishing Pros should be on your slide, and you should turn to the next slide. Kick it out the door, step 12. You've written it. Trusted colleagues have read it. It's time to kick it out the door. But three things interfere: pride, perfectionism, and fear of rejection. New slide. Even Snoopy, he was always writing a book, but he never finished one. And if you look at this Snoopy slide, you'll see why. New slide. Select appropriate journals. Don't be drawn like a moth to the flame to only the so-called best journals, which have 95 and 98 and 99% rejection rates. Nearly a third of education journals reject 90% of what is submitted to them, Ken Henson tells us. Wait for someone in the know to suggest the best journals without your prompting. Consider moderately ranked journals. Consider themed issues. Themed issues, one journal editor said, have four times the chance of being published in his journal than other non-themed issues, but they still have the same brand name. Read your bibliography to find appropriate journals. Ask little e and capital E experts. And my personal favorite tip on this point is contact journal editors directly. It's called querying. One editor, Van Til, says query, always query. It's the first law of Van Til. How do you query? You email the journal editor. This is a new slide. It should say, how do you query, in the middle of the slide. Email the journal editor. Ask how well, this is the hook, how well your paper fits the journal's mission. Because the journal mission was written a long time ago. So you want to know how well it fits their understanding, I should have said that, their understanding of the journal's mission, because the mission was written a long time ago and they've been in job 2 years. So you want to know how it fits where they're taking the journal. It's not that you haven't read the mission. It's that you want to know how it fits their vision of the journal. I include the title and the abstract in the email, and I attach the whole paper. I wait 2 weeks, and I write again. And I am always thanking the editor whether they accept the paper or not. If they reject it, they have saved me months of waiting. New slide. Celebrate every revise and resubmit. I didn't talk about it today, but there's between 8 and 37 criticisms of each paper by each reviewer. So multiply that by 3 and you could have over 100 criticisms of your work. It's kind of hard to celebrate, but you should anyway. New slide. In education journals, 15% of first-time submissions are accepted with revisions. In contrast, 75% of revise and resubmits are accepted with revisions. So that means if you turn in a revise and resubmit, and they say, yes, we'll take it if you'll make these changes. That happens 75% of the time for revise and resubmits, but only 15% of the time for first-time submissions. So you should rejoice when you get a revise and resubmit. New slide. The cardinal sin of academic publishing is not to revise and resubmit. New slide. You've written it. Trusted colleagues have read it. It's time to kick it out the door. But you say it could be better. It's not finished. It isn't done. That's true today. It will be true tomorrow. And it will be true 100 years from now. Artists are encouraged not to overpaint a picture and bury a good idea in a muddy mess. And so it is with writers. We've got to find a balance between making it better and getting it done. It reminds me of an old song. You've got to know when to hold 'em, know when to fold 'em, Know when to walk away and know when to run to your mailbox. You never doubt your writing. While you're sitting at the table, there'll be time enough for doubting when the writing's done. Don't worry, reviewers are not known for being overkind. Your job is to write it and mail it. The reviewer's job is to tell you if you will embarrass yourself publicly. New slide. You've done your job, so make them do theirs. Just kick it out the door and make them say yes.
This has been an educational presentation brought to you by the Text and Academic Authors Association.